Merci à Sophie, et merci à Maud, et merci à vous aussi. C'est une autre femme exceptionnelle, mais une femme un peu différente de la résistance. Alors, in her fascinating memoir, Toute ma vie, the renowned Meneuse de Revue, Miss Stengett, confided, all the props of life find their meeting place on the stage of the music hall. Flowers, women, colors, staircases and ostrich feathers, fools and lovers, the good folk and the bad. And I am there to animate them. I set the pace, and the rest follow. I found my life in the spectacle and tumult of the Grand Review. One of the most popular celebrities of the 20th century, Miss Stengett, née Jean Florentine Bourgeois, enjoyed a long and prosperous career in the French and then international entertainment industry. For over 50 years, she delighted audiences, honing her craft first in the Café Concert of Fin de Siècle Paris before conquering the post-war music hall, appearing in 62 feature films and releasing several hit singles. Yet the tremendous cultural and commercial success of Miss Stengett's films and musical recordings paled in comparison to her phenomenal triumphs on the stage. As the reigning and undisputed queen of the Paris Music Hall in the 1920s, Miss Stengett enchanted spectators, built her celebrity, and found her life in the spectacle of the Grand Review. Whether on stage at the Casino de Paris, the El Dorado, the Folies Bergères, or the Moulin Rouge, Miss Stengett energetically and audaciously animated the props of life. Although reviews featured song and dance numbers, comedic interludes, acrobatic performances, and even my favorite choreographed animal acts, the main attraction was always the fashioned body of its female star. Miss Stengett's risque, glittering costumes, and her flamboyantly feathered headdresses enchanted the mixed class, mixed sexed audiences of Paris's post-war music halls. Amid a mesmerizing tableau of sparkling jewels, sumptuous gowns, and scantily clad chorus girls, Miss Stengett launched modern music hall fashion and set the pace for the rest to follow. But how exactly did an unknown upstart from the northern suburbs of Paris transform herself into a music hall icon? How did she differentiate herself from other aspiring female artists? And why would she be the one who ultimately set the pace for the rest to follow? As fans, biographers, and critics will attest, Miss Stengett was a skilled stage performer who worked diligently at her craft. However, she was also a savvy self-promoter who learned early in her career how to use the tools of glamour and fashion to produce a modern model of female celebrity. To understand how Miss Stengett produced this model, my talk today will unfold in three parts. The first part provides an overview of glamour's meanings, its relationship to celebrity, and its particular relevance for Miss Stengett. The second and third parts focus on Miss Stengett's stage career, calling attention to the ways she used stage fashion and performance to broaden glamour's meanings by highlighting its inherent contradictions. Tracing Miss Stengett's metamorphosis from Café Concert Chanteuse to Queen of the Grand Review, these sections illuminate the hidden work of glamour in the fashioning of modern celebrity, at the same time that they reveal how for celebrities like Miss Stengett, glamour always required work. Like the stage fashions that she animated, glamour was a key component of Miss Stengett's star image. Before we can consider how Miss Stengett used glamour to fashion her celebrity, however, it is necessary to explain exactly what we mean by the term. A spatially and temporally contingent concept, glamour is relatively easy to recognize but difficult to define. We know it sort of when we see it, even if we can't always articulate exactly what it is or how it works. In other words, to put it more elegantly, as Stephen Gundel has, glamour becomes legible only through a shared understanding of the three primary value-laden signifiers through which it is expressed. And for Gundel, That includes the trappings of glamour, the qualities of glamour, and the oxymoronic qualities of glamour, which I will discuss in turn. The first and most concrete of its iterations, the trappings of glamour, includes cosmetics, clothing, fashion accessories, and of course for Miss Dingette, shoes, instruments that together visibly communicate glamour on the human body. The second and less tangible quality component of glamour is its qualities. Beauty, sexuality, theatricality, wealth, etc. Those things that are not enacted on the body, but rather through the body, that require execution via a personality, right? So someone like a Miss Dingette to enliven them, to bring them to life. Finally, the seemingly straightforward trappings and qualities of glamour are often muddled by this third signifier, what Gundel calls its oxymoronic qualities, the quote, sleazy elegance, accessible exclusivity, and democratic elitism, the incompatible pairings that lie at its core. And we see those at play here in a poster advertisement for the Moulin Rouge Revue Miss Dingette from 1925, where of course she is focused in the center. The nudes are positioned around her in this scene of decadence that is both on the one hand artistic, but also slightly what Gundel would say sleazy, right, or inappropriate for all audiences. In Gundel's assessment, all bodies and personalities might aspire to glamour, but only through fantasy and fashioning can they achieve it. Tokens of excess and abundance, brightly colored cosmetics, sumptuously layered fabrics, and glittering accessories might call attention to the otherwise unremarkable body, but without an exceptional personality to articulate them, these trappings fail to generate the idealized image of the self that glamour requires, or to produce its broader cultural meanings. If glamour cannot transpire without a personality to enliven it, it also, and this is key, particularly when thinking about modern celebrities, it also cannot exist without an audience to appreciate it. You can't be glamorous if there's no one there to see it, right? So you have to also have viewers, spectators on hand. Reliant then upon props, personality, and audience, glamour is thus necessarily performative and spectacular. Not surprisingly, it is through embodied public performance that glamour achieves its cultural currency, and through which it establishes a framework for fashioning celebrity. In the 19th century, glamour and celebrity developed alongside the expansion of markets, the rise of democratic regimes, the growth of the theater industry, and the escalating theatricality of social life. By the early 20th century, as Miss Dingette's illustrious career demonstrates, both glamour and celebrity became inextricably linked in the figure of the female performer. To illustrate this evolution, the remainder of my talk traces Miss Dingette's metamorphosis from small stage entertainer to grand revue queen, paying particular attention to the role fashion played in that transition. To this end, I will explore how Miss Dingette employed the trappings of glamour, evoked its qualities, and even engaged its oxymoronic qualities to create her star image. Born to a Belgian father and French mother in the Petite Bourgeois district of Paris's northern suburbs, Jeanne Bourgeois seemed an unlikely candidate for international stardom. Yet from an early age, she knew she was destined to be something or other. In her youth, she demanded music lessons, assembled neighborhood children to stage productions of Molière, and she clandestinely infiltrated concert halls, sneaking backstage to watch the performers at work. When she embarked upon her own professional career in Paris's Café Concert, she cultivated the persona of the ordinary Parisienne, appearing on stage in rags, in drag, and covered in some of the most unappealing face paints. Through her early roles and apprenticeships, moreover, she confronted the hardships of theater life, and she discovered the important role that fashion and self-fashioning played in creating the illusion of celebrity glamour. Bourgeois learned early on that celebrities, to paraphrase Simone de Beauvoir, are not born but must become glamorous. As a teenager, she was particularly taken with the popular chanteuse Anna Thiboux. Along with her mother, she had encountered the singer on several occasions. However, it was her first solo meeting with Thiboux that would leave its lasting impression. Bourgeois arrived at the singer's home, eager to impress her with a new, more mature hairstyle. Remember, she's a teenage girl who's awestruck by this singing idol. Aware of the girl's theatrical aspirations, Thiboux told her bluntly, "The hair is certainly an improvement, but you're no beauty, you know. You're much too plain for the theater. If you want to be a success on stage, child, you must have looks." When Bourgeois protested that talent must also account for something, Thiboux interrupted her. "Nonsense. Look at my friend here. She's got no talent, but she's pretty. The men flock round her. She has a drawer full of jewelry, and all her bills are paid. She's a star. You'll never be anything but an insignificant little walk-on. So take my advice and stay home like a good girl." Bourgeois conceded that Anna Thiboux was right, of course. I was no beauty. I had two teeth too many in front, which a dentist cousin of mine pulled out later. I even wore a brace off and on. I grew like a weed, and I looked like what I was, an urchin. I certainly could not rely on my looks. I never have. Despite Thiboux's harsh critique of her physical defects, Bourgeois had no intention of staying home like a good girl. "I had one gift," she proclaimed, "vitality. The rest had still to be created. I had to invent everything, discover where my bent lay, make myself into something." Like many aspiring starlets, Bourgeois romanticized theater life. And like those fortunate or unfortunate enough to meet their idols, she also uncovered the hidden artifices that celebrities employed to sustain the mask of fantasy. In her memoir, she described her first visit to an actress's dressing room as, quote, "a bitter disappointment." "I had seen the show once," she recalled, "and thought her, the headlining actress, the loveliest, liveliest, gayest creature I had ever set eyes on. I knocked at the door, cradling a bunch of roses, breathless with excitement. A sharp voice called, 'Come in,' and I saw a tired-looking woman in a tawdry sateen gown preparing to clean off a hideous mask of ochre and green, out of which her eyes and their circles of stiff, spiky black lashes stared with a cold indifference." In the loge of her reluctant hostess, Bourgeois, for the first time, glimpsed how the trappings of glamour concealed the exhausted and somewhat physically unexceptional actress who animated them. Rather than repel her, however, the discovery seemed to reassure her and, in fact, strengthened her resolve to pursue a life in theater. "That was my first encounter with the seamy side of the theater," she confessed. "But I cannot say that when I saw her next from the front, she was one whit less glamorous to me. It would have taken a lot more than thick grease paint and cheap finery to disillusion me." Convinced of her own physical plainness and assured that glamour was something that one put on rather than something one was, Bourgeois transformed herself into Miss Stangette by performing two artistic styles that enabled her to rely on her vitality instead of on her looks. Between 1895 and 1905, she performed as a gamuse, kicking up her petticoats, dancing Spanish style, even performing the cakewalk in 1903, serenading predominantly working-class patrons with bawdy songs and engaging spectators with lurid innuendo. And here are some images of her early career, and then I'll talk more about this one. Into the pre-war years, she enacted the base humor and physical comedy of the chanteuse épileptique, a performance style that emphasized peculiar bodily contortions and exaggerated facial expressions. Through these early performances, Miss Stangette pursued her own brand of glamour. Playing a range of common characters, Miss Stangette made street urchins, sweatshop workers, and even female criminals glamorous. She did so by claiming a personal affinity with these marginal characters, whom she portrayed as romantic and eroticized representations of urban poverty. We see an example of how Miss Dinguette used fashion and performance to glamorize urban poverty in one of her most memorable comedic roles as the streetwise rag picker Flora in La Môme Flora, which she performed at the Scala in 1908. Not exactly the image one conjures when thinking about the glamorous superstar of the Parisian stage. Adorned in torn, oversized unisex flannels, basic black tights, and clunky, ill-fitting boots, and completely devoid of accessories save the abused messenger bag in her hand, Flora completely lacked the sumptuous costuming, the sensual figure, beautiful face, or mask of grease paints that so often communicated female stage glamour. Yet by animating the props of life, in this case, the gritty urban attire that her audiences all too readily recognized, Miss Dinguette's stage fashioning was not a renunciation of glamour, but an open expression of its oxymoronic qualities. As Flora, Miss Dinguette epitomized precisely the sleazy elegance, accessible exclusivity, and democratic elitism through which glamour itself was fashioned. Glamour's ability to be simultaneously elegant and sleazy, democratic and exclusive, would emerge not only in Miss Dinguette's portrayal of characters like Flora, but also in how she configured her own celebrity image. Throughout her career, as scholar Jerry Harris has explained, Miss Dinguette, quote, frequently changed register from star to woman of the people, or rather played both registers at once, embodying the fantasies and social aspirations of the poorer sections of her audience, while allying herself with the bourgeoisie by reaffirming their perceptions of the people. Although Harris specifically references Miss Dinguette's onstage characters, her observation applies to how the performer crafted her offstage persona as well. In the early days, Miss Dinguette, the girl who could not rely on her looks, perpetually transformed her appearance, blending the tawdry and the tasteful, playing upon her perceived plainness to showcase her inner vitality. It would be that vitality, along with millions of feathers, that would eventually propel Miss Dinguette to superstardom. Miss Dinguette's career evolved in tandem with the expansion of Parisian music halls, which grew in numbers themselves from 42 in 1920 to 47 by 1927. At this time, the more casual atmosphere and modest stage shows of the fin de siècle gave way to the lavish spectacle of the Grand Revue. Although Miss Dinguette lacked the vocal range of some of her contemporaries, she won audiences over by showcasing her diversity of skills. I sing, I dance, I am an acrobat. I make folk cry, and I make them laugh, she boasted. One might say I was universal. No other woman does what I do. Playing up the contrast between her deliberately unpolished singing style and the extravagant stage tableau, moreover, she explained that audiences loved me with my ostrich feathers and my legs and my teeth and my funny, friendly face. Thus, even as the undisputed star of the Grand Revue, Miss Dinguette continued to embody and to perform glamour's contradictions. An innovator as well as an entertainer, Miss Dinguette forever changed the world of stage fashion. She introduced the ornate headdresses and pioneered the high-heeled stair descent that would become the signatures of the modern showgirl. So Las Vegas can thank her for those costumes. Her unique capacity to animate gaudy stage fashions, moreover, distinguished her from other female performers and became the cornerstone of her star image. Audiences marveled at Miss Dinguette's ability to descend staircases wearing 15 pounds of plumes upon her head while dragging several more yards of feathers and fabrics behind her. Meanwhile, in the press, the star herself divulged that her clothing, feather, and jewelry budget for a single show might exceed 150,000 francs. My dressing room was a jungle of feathers, flowers, and mirrors, Miss Dinguette once boasted. In Perry Kiri, I wore 120,000 francs worth of paradise plumes on my head. This was 1918, and two dressers had to escort me to the wings to hold up the jewel-encrusted panniers of my costume. Although Miss Stangette made several wardrobe changes throughout a show, nothing compared to the elaborate creations that she donned for her grand finales. In the grand finale of the birds, wren, sparrow, finch, eagle, ostrich, with Venetian nudes and Spanish showgirls and their outsized feather hats, she raved, it was the star who had the most clothes upon her back. For another performance, her, quote, boy designer, Gasma, had made me my sumptuous bird of paradise costume. It was made of thousands of multicolored plumes, open down the front and ending in a huge feathery train. With it, I wore a headdress 3 feet high of feathers and a jeweled band. By the end of the 1920s, Miss Stangette's costumes, particularly her feathered headdresses, rivaled only her stardom in size and stature. In January 1930, I beat my own record, she exclaimed, by wearing a feathered headdress of a size no one, not even myself, had ever worn before. It was 2 meters high, a kind of Eiffel Tower in miniature, with a myriad of tiny plumes that waved and nodded under the multicolored lights of the Casino de Paris and quivered at the slightest breath of air like a bevy of butterflies. So adorned, Miss Stangette enraptured critic Michel Georges Michel, who recounted another of the performer's amazing stage entrances this way. For the next scene, Miss wears 120,000 francs worth of paradise feathers on her head or on her costume, the whole edifice supported until her entry by two maids. With these in attendance, she takes up position immediately behind the grand staircase, down which are already defiling a procession of every sort of bird, finches, sparrows, ostriches. Each costume has a feather headdress a foot or so higher than the one before. The cheers that greet it go according to the length of the plumes. By the same token, when Miss Stangette herself at last appears in a headdress that reaches almost up to the rafters of the theater, delirium breaks out. Georges Michel's use of the word delirium to describe the audience's response to Miss Stangette's onstage wardrobe, particularly to her feathered headdress, captured not only the crowd's reaction to the spectacle's excess, but also insinuated its erotic fascination with the show's star. In the context of the Grand Revue, feathers were more than mere props. Like the female body that they playfully ornamented, they stimulated the senses, teasing the eyes and begging for touch. Their lightness, especially the weightlessness of ostrich feathers, which accounted for the majority of feathers used in Miss Stangette's costumes, moved effortlessly with the body and appeared as an extension of the performer herself. Feathers that seductively accentuated the body's sensuality could, of course, signal to the audience the performer's sexual availability. Moreover, because of their comparative low cost, feathers were considered cheap and lowbrow, and thus reinforced the popular and long-held French association between female stage performers and prostitution. For many members in the audience, then, feathers were not only trappings of glamour that enhanced the spectacle, they were also indicators of the showgirl's sexual promiscuity. Although desperate to prove that, for all the apparent looseness of my way of life, I was a good girl, Miss Stangette encouraged the fetishization and commodification of her own fashioned body. Feathered headdresses aside, most of Miss Stangette's stage costumes were designed to show off her most alluring and marketable physical asset, her legs. "My legs," Miss Stangette once extolled. "The word is out. People have talked about my legs ever since I became Miss Stangette." More than any other feature, costume, or indeed any role, Miss Stangette's celebrity was associated with her legs. And for her part, Miss Stangette recognized their centrality to her star image. "I had to invent everything," she extolled. "Even my legs, the loveliest in the world, came out of my head. That's why the world came to look at them." Miss Stengett openly addressed the popular fascination with her legs in her 1930s co-authored tell-all, Miss Stengett and Her Confessions. In one essay in the collection, she acknowledged that she had given her legs a good deal of consideration. In 1920, the latest edition of La Ruse contained under the heading Legs an article which began, "The legs serve to carry the trunk, but like the columns of antiquity, singularly embellish the edifice they support." Like La Ruse, she wrote coyly, "I think that a woman devoid of harmonious legs is nothing but an inelegant animal. I would not have the temerity to describe my legs. I don't think I could if I tried. I know them too well, or not well enough. Besides, I have never seen them as others see them. As far as I'm concerned, my legs are for walking, running, jumping, and dancing." Functionality aside, Miss Stengett's legs also held tremendous commercial value. Throughout her career, but especially during her time on the Grand Review, photographs and publicity materials blatantly featured them. "They have done me very well," she admitted. "In 1919, I insured them for 500,000 francs, the cost of a house on the Champs-Élysées." As much shrewd businesswoman as talented performer, Miss Stengett understood that people came to the Review not just to see a show, but also to visually and virtually consume expensive jewels, ostentatious costumes, and amazing bodies. Audiences thus demanded the glamorous props of life that only the music hall, which combined erotic spectacle and sexual commerce, could offer. Part commodified erotic spectacle, part talented entertainer, part astute businesswoman, Miss Stengett committed to the work of glamour in order to produce and then secure her celebrity. Gundel has argued that showgirls employed in the popular theater succumbed to such work because most of them were, quote, "rootless young women who became glamorous only by donning feathers, sequins, and furs to seduce and enchant their audience." The star of the Grand Review, Miss Stengett was certainly not the average showgirl, nor did she qualify as a rootless young woman in the conventional sense. And yet, like her colleagues, she too recognized the disconnect between the spectacle and the women who animated it. She understood, as Gundel would later point out, that the image of the showgirl was an artificial contrivance behind which there was hard work, regimentation, and even humiliation. In her own recounting of music hall life, Miss Stengett often downplayed the glitzy aspects of celebrity to focus instead on the hard work that went into making and maintaining it. To this end, she chronicled a typical workday from the height of her career. Wake at 6, film at the studio until noon, rehearse for the tour in the afternoon, then fittings, set and costume conference, press interviews, letter dictation, making appointments for auditions, manicure, foot massage and hair, followed by dinner and makeup at 8:30, a 9 o'clock curtain call, and finished off with a late supper or nightclub appearance. "I only feel really at ease in an atmosphere of work," Miss Stengett explained her grueling schedule. "I've always had the idea, an idea that amounted to an obsession, that I must deserve what I possessed, from the food I ate to the houses I lived in and the clothes I wore, and that I had to spend myself before I could sit down and enjoy life." And here we see the big Grand Review from the Moulin Rouge in 1925 and some of the behind-the-scenes activities with which she was engaged. Unlike stage divas who eschewed the banality of daily rehearsals and refused to bother themselves with the functional aspects of producing a show, Miss Stengett was involved in every aspect of a Review's production. In addition to starring in and co-producing her first headlining show for the Moulin Rouge, La Revue Miss Stengett, Miss Stengett oversaw casting and costuming. "I chose the girls myself. I interviewed them by the score. Take off your clothes," I would say. "I would study the girl from all angles. I might undress 100 to find 10. On opening night, she expounded, "It was me who dressed them. I had to keep an eye on them, maybe a bit of a control freak. I made short work of any who showed themselves rebellious to cleanliness. Any girl who appeared more than once with grubby nails and greasy hair could find herself another job." As a Review manager, moreover, she kept track of house receipts, transport charges, hotel bills, and incidental expenses, priding herself on knowing the price of everything wherever we went in whatever currency. I was not often caught out. For Miss Stengett, then, Glamour was part of the production. It was a form of work, and like the public that adored her, it was a demanding taskmaster. It has become somewhat commonplace in academic literature devoted to 20th century celebrity to associate modern glamour with a star system that emerged in Hollywood in the 1930s and 1940s. I have suggested today, however, that we see its nascent forms already in the 1920s, and we witness its embryonic burgeoning not on an American soundstage, but in the vibrant music halls of France. We also see it, perhaps most poignantly, in the figure of Miss Stengett. As the queen of the Grand Revue, as I have argued, Miss Stengett employed glamour's trappings. She embodied its qualities, and she engaged its oxymoronic qualities to fashion a model of female celebrity that would be appreciated and imitated across the 20th century. Throughout her career, Miss Stengett exposed the myriad ways that glamour and celebrity fashioned one another. She did so by cultivating glamour's qualities, as well as by tenaciously animating its most decadent trappings. Among the many accessories that she employed to this end, none were more magnificent, more memorable than her elaborately feathered headdresses. If Miss Stengett's headdresses incited the imagination and sustained the mirage upon which a performance rested, then her notorious legs stimulated spectator desire. Significantly, neither of these trappings of glamour could perform such tasks without an exceptional personality to animate them. Both Miss Stengett's headdresses and her legs would have remained little more than inanimate props had she not had the power, what she called her vitality, to draw out their beauty, sexuality, and theatricality. In addition to engaging the trappings and qualities of glamour, Miss Stengett also navigated its pesky oxymoronic qualities, even courting her own contradictions to fashion her celebrity. To this end, her particular brand of glamour frequently blended the common and the vulgar with the chic and the sublime. At various points in her career, she portrayed herself as a woman of the people, playing gritty roles that require drab, understated attire. Yet these performances were tempered by the many roles that demanded that she adorn herself with all of the trappings of glamour: high-heeled shoes, beaded gowns, opulent headdresses, even a pair of shapely legs that one body could animate. Through both her stage costuming and her self-fashioning, Miss Stengett revealed glamour's chameleon-like capacity to be simultaneously ostentatious and understated, exclusive and democratic, contextual and inherent. Her example illustrated, moreover, that it was because of glamour's contradictions, rather than in spite of them, that glamour persevered as a desirable and effective vehicle for fashioning modern celebrity. As she contemplated her theatrical legacy near the end of her life, Miss Stengett quite matter-of-factly explained that there will be no more Miss Stengetts. The line will begin and end with me. There may be a second Jean Bourgeois, my niece, but she will not be my double. She has far too much personality. Although Miss Stengett speaks quite literally here of the hereditary transference of her name, her comment is nevertheless intriguing. On the one hand, how could the woman who set the pace for the rest to follow, who created the prototype for the modern showgirl, and who provided a model of female celebrity that would be emulated even during her own lifetime, suggest that she was to be the last of her kind? On the other hand, if she believed that her own exceptionalism was rooted in her personality and that vitality that distinguished her from everyone else, how could it be that anyone, including her niece, might possibly possess too much personality? Perhaps Miss Stengett was merely over-dramatizing the fact that she would be the one and only person to bear her name. Or maybe, and I suspect this is more likely the explanation, she was celebrating that fact. We may never know. What we do know, however, is that she fashioned that name in the music halls of Paris, where night after night she donned amazing costumes to dazzle audiences with a glamour that was uniquely her own. Thank you.
So as you were talking, I thought about two things. I thought about another kind of scrappy upstart in the 1910s who became glamorous by the clothes that she put on, Coco Chanel.
Right.
And then in the middle, I started to think about Kim Kardashian.
There is that uncertainty.
And the production of glamour. Mm-hmm. And also Kim Kardashian as, you know, the counterpoint, right, to Miss Saget, who shows kind of the routine banality of glamour, which is something that maybe modern celebrities tend not to do these days. That was just my mind wandering as you were talking. So let me open up for questions if the audience has them. Do you have any questions? Otherwise, I can keep going.
There's one in the back.
Yeah.
I'll stand so I can hear.
Again, that was a really great intervention. I was wondering, as you were coming to the end, if so you set up very well the idea that Jeanne Bourgeois had this character, Miss Tanguet, and underneath she was somebody else, I suppose. And I wonder if there's something else that she did as Jeanne Bourgeois, or is this maybe why she says that she doesn't have enough personality?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Because in her memoir, for example, she claims to be telling us her true story, right? And in her earlier, her confessions, right? That we're going to learn something about the real person behind the celebrity. And yet that real person never quite manifests, right? Mm-hmm. So there are glimpses of this little girl who was Jeanne Bourgeois, mm-hmm. but they kind of go away after the celebrity begins to develop. And even those images are selected to create the celebrity. Right. So I think it's that disconnect between the celebrity as identity, the celebrity as persona, and then this other person, this woman who is there, that makes that play on if there's going to be another Bourgeois or if there's going to be another Miss Tanguet, very murky to figure out. I think that's the central tension of celebrity generally, but particularly for women like Miss Tanguet.
And along the same lines of what Maud was saying, how do you pronounce it? Do you pronounce it in French or in English? Okay. Do you see any differences between the star system now and the, like, Kardashian? And what would you say is a big difference between...
Well, I think that she had some talent, which I would not always attribute
that's not very nice.
To the Kardashians, although I know there's a scholar in Belfast who would disagree with me about that. But I think that...
Let's take Beyonce.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. There are many similarities, right? It's the hiding, the hard work. I think what's interesting to me as I look at performers in the early 20th century, and another example of this would be even Colette, right, when she's talking about music hall life. It's this unveiling of this is a métier. There is work that takes place here. And it's not just we appear on stage as these glamorous ephemeral figures, right, but there's a lot of hard work. And I think that in the age of social media, right, in the 21st century, we see more of that than maybe we otherwise would. But I think that there was more of an effort at the time to really expose that we really worked hard. That's why I talk about glamour even as a form of work. So I think that for me, that would be something that is a bit different in that there's this desire to be taken seriously in a particular kind of genre that demands a lot of grueling work on the body, work on beauty, work on fashion, a lot of cultural knowledge, as well as some semblance of talent. This surely is the same today, but there's not the same emphasis on showing it by the person themselves necessarily. And I'm not an expert on Beyonce, so maybe she has some great blog or something I don't know about where she does all of this.
As you were just saying that, it made me think of fashion and fashion houses, the Maison de Couture in this time, which have a very distinct barrier between the front where the clothes are sold and the back where the clothes are being made. Mm-hmm. And that in fashion there is no desire to show the behind the scenes, to show how hard it is to create these beautiful couture gowns, right? So the gown is presented as is, and the backstage is very rarely shown. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all know those like very rare backstage images, and we all use the same ones time and time and time again when we're talking about fashion during this time, because they're really rare.
Well, and that's really interesting, too, because there's quite a complicated relationship between high fashion and the music hall, right? That it does have this tawdry connotation. And honestly, if we go back to this
I mean, who's going to wear that, you know, walking down the street? So that's why I made the point about the connotation of ostrich feathers as being particularly cheap or déclassé, as, you know, not something.
What year are these from?
These are from the 20s. I can't remember which year exactly. I have them in my notes. but, you know, the idea that this is something different. This is not something that's going to be, you know, Chanel is not going to take this on. Right. She may incorporate some elements, but it's not going to be replica. So it's not high fashion. Right. So that also makes it something sort of the people in a really interesting way. I think similar to like a Kardashian, right? That even though there are these really not of the people, people relate to them as reality stars, right? In particular ways. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your question.
If you speak into the microphone, then we record it.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's good.
I always feel like I talk so
much. My question is very simple, but Mr. Get for me is a voice more than a body. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised that you did not say anything about her way of singing, which was people's slang at the same time, very high. Peach, not
but yes.
So it's a very strange voice too,
yes.
And very oxymoric.
Again. Yes, and I should have made more of that in terms of the oxymoronic quality.
Yes.
But for today's talk, I was really trying to focus sort of on this creation of celebrity through the review itself.
Yes.
And other scholars, Kelly Conway, for example, has done a book on the realist singer where she makes much of that voice.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right, so thank you.
Could you say a few words of Miss Tinguette's glamour off the stage? Because she was a client of Paul Poiret, of Jeanne Lanvin, and she had a true relation with her image off the stage, and very different from the one we have here on the screen. So
yes.
Could you say a few words about that?
Absolutely. So that's actually something I'm looking at in another article that I'm working on, where I talk about the sort of the two versions, right? That she very much presents herself in her memoir as a woman who wants to be respectable. And being dressed by Poiret, by Lanvin, by comporting herself the way she does in public as the good girl superstar very much, I think, plays to that image that she definitely wants the glamour, right? She enjoys that. That's an element. So that's where her bread and butter is. That's how she makes her money. But she also has this desire. She sets up house, right? She takes in all of these wayward people and treats them like what she calls her children. You know, she tries to sort of domesticate this image to be, I think, more approachable, to be more respectable. And I think that's probably why these designers were willing to dress her as well.
Right, Antoine, do you have archives? Antoine?
Dommage.
I have one drawing. But recently in an auction there were invoices because Miss Tinguette didn't pay it. Invoices to Lanvin.
Wow. Maybe more like the Kardashians than I thought.
Really fascinating talk. What was her relationship with Josephine Baker? Because I'm not really
they were
this period, but were they
performing at the same time?
They
were sort of competing showgirl figures, and they knew each other. I don't know. I'm working on Josephine Baker as well. I don't know if they performed together. I don't think so, but they definitely matriculated in the same circles. And what's interesting is when she does the cakewalk early, right? She adopts a lot of what was considered black or African-American dance style in her acts, even before Baker and the Revue Nègre arrive in France. So there's a lot of intersection there, but I need to find out more. Thank you.
Well, actually, can you go back? I'll go for one. Okay, so that top right, that looks like a dance move that Josephine Baker would make.
Yeah.
So I think that's so interesting that she was photographed like that. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of the similarities, actually. Mm-hmm. Although I think that Baker really made fun of herself a lot, you know, and I think she was not
not there.
Oui, je m'excuse, je parle trop mal l'anglais pour m'exprimer en anglais, mais d'elle aussi, il y a un rapport très fort qui est aussi une image glamour, c'est qu'elle servait d'image pour tout aussi, tous les phénomènes sportifs de l'époque. On la voit dans les films, dans les courses automobiles, on la voit jouant de ce sport-là au Luxembourg avec ressort. On la voit accompagner des courses aussi des garçons de café. Enfin, elle est aussi glamour et du coup, elle est une image symbolique comme peuvent être certaines femmes glamour de notre époque. Et là, elle a lancé vraiment aussi ce côté idole et partout. Elle était très sportive aussi.
Oui. So the question is, she is very
sporty. I mean, just yes, sporty. Like, yeah.
Mais on la voit beaucoup, hein, accompagner les courses automobiles, habillée comme ça, en fait, courant.
Oui,
can
in English? It's too difficult to think in French. I think that's very true, that the athleticism of the dancer, you know, that the type of physical comedy that she performed was definitely an important aspect of her celebrity as well. Did I not answer? I'm sorry.
It's not really a question, but Louis Rousselet was my grandfather. And we can have a talk if you want.
Thank you.
Because I know this picture very well.
Really?
She was a great, great friend of my grandfather.
I'd love to talk. Thank you.
On va reparler. Donc, merci beaucoup, merci Harley.
Merci beaucoup, merci à vous.